Welcome to the podcast called Battle for African Agriculture, the space where we challenge dominant narratives and imagine just sustainable futures, especially when it comes to food and farming in Africa. Today's episode features Dr. Titi Adebola. She's a leading scholar in intellectual property law and food systems governance, based at the University of Aberdeen, Scotland. Her work explores how international and national laws intersect with agricultural development, trade, and the colonial legacies embedded in our legal frameworks, particularly around seed and biodiversity. Dr. Adebola has been a powerful advocate for reclaiming African legal sovereignty, especially through her analysis of the African Modern Law on PVP, a landmark attempt that centers farmers' rights and community knowledge in African seed governance. As African countries face growing pressure to align with UPO of 1991, through trade agreements, donor leverage, and regional harmonization bodies, this conversation comes at a critical moment. Welcome, Titi.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. So, Titi, can you share your journey into food and agriculture law? How you came to focus on plant variety protection?
Thank you. That's an interesting question that I love. Mm. I first learned about intellectual property during my postgraduate studies at the University of Warwick. I took a course on international intellectual property law, and one of the classes was on plant variety protection. Mm. My lecturer, who then became my supervisor, Dr. Dwijen Wangneka, spoke so passionately about intellectual property rights for seeds. He talked about a seed having a hardware and a software.
Okay.
The hardware was the external part of the seed, and the software were the plant genetic resources.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was talking about the contestations and the protection of these plant genetic resources and its implication for food sovereignty, for food security. Mm-hmm. And I was just completely fascinated. Mm-hmm. I had not thought about a seed as having a hardware and a software. And that was the beginning of my journey into intellectual property rights for plants. Mm-hmm. And then my dad, my parents, my dad, my mom, my siblings encouraged me to do a PhD.
Uh-huh.
And my decision was that if I was going to do a PhD, then I was going to do it on a subject that I loved.
Mm-hmm.
And plant variety protection was my immediate choice.
Oh, fantastic.
So I went on to do my PhD on plant variety protection, also at the University of Warwick.
That's a fantastic story. We have to thank you, doctor. For the general public, seed laws might seem abstract, you know? So why are they important, particularly in the African context?
Africa is very biodiverse. Africa is rich in plant genetic resources. And one of the wealths that we have on the continent is just the wide range of food crops that we have and the different varieties of those food crops. Therefore, if Africa is going to continue to contribute to producing food globally, I think that protecting our plant varieties would be an important factor for Africa to take into consideration.
Thank you. It's very good. Well put. Let's begin historically.
Yes.
How did colonial regimes shape the legal systems that govern agriculture and biodiversity in Africa today? I'm not talking about the past, I'm talking about the present.
I think that historically, when African countries became colonies, there was, first of all, an identification of the types of products that were going to be beneficial to the empires. And then there was a gradual shift to the commercialization of those products. And then there was a prioritization of the products that were going to be beneficial economically. And so we see that in many countries, many of our staples were gradually marginalized or sidelined. And then there was a focus on cash crops for exports. And that historical disruption is still framing the trajectory of food production in Africa. So many of the staple crops and the different varieties that we have of our staple crops have gradually gone into extinction, and there's just a focus on few crops at the moment. So that historical disruption is still a continuity till date.
Now, people talk about cocoa for Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana, cotton for Mali and Burkina Faso. What was the case for Nigeria?
We had a number of crops. I think we also had cocoa that was exported. Mm-hmm. We had a number of crops.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you see today's PVP regimes, particularly those modeled on UPA of 1991, as extension of this colonial legacy?
Absolutely. Mm. So the PVP regimes that are focused on the International Convention for the Protection of New Varieties of Plants are focused mainly on industrialized crops. Mm-hmm. So while you might have both food crops, you might have other, you might have horticulture, you might have flowers, etc. Mm-hmm. But the focus really is on commercialization. Mm-hmm. So what types of crops are going to bring the greatest commercial benefits. That's the focus. So it's not really about food sovereignty. It's not really about considering the interest of the small-scale producers. It's not really about considering the nutritional value of the crops for the populace. It is really about thinking about what type of crops are going to provide the most commercial benefits.
Yeah,
and that has been the focus. So when you talk about provisions under the UPOV 1991 specifically, for example, we know the conditions for protection. So they have to be new, commercial novelty, they have to be distinct, they have to be uniform, they have to be stable.
Yeah.
And for you to meet those conditions, small-scale farmers' varieties would not meet those conditions because of the heterogeneity in the production mechanisms that we employ. So that means you're introducing systems that are marginalizing about 80% of the population who are small-scale farmers that produce crops that would not meet those conditions for protection. And importantly, UPOV also includes that no additional provision can be incorporated in a UPOV-styled law. So that means that even though a country could consider having two layers, so for example, a country could consider having new, distinct, uniform, stable for industrialized crops, and then having another set of conditions for farmers' varieties, UPOV has expressly stated that would not be approved in a UPOV-styled law. Mm. So that means you're introducing a law that only speaks and caters to a specific sector, and that marginalizes small-scale farmers.
Yeah, no, we're living in a crisis, as you know. Mm-hmm. You know, we are in a health crisis, environmental crisis, especially the climate crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And what this crisis needs is diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So we are very much happy that our varieties in the hands of farmers are not uniform and are not stable.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So it's a blessing in disguise that we are still diverse.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So how does intellectual property law developed in the global north fit or fail to fit into the agricultural African agricultural realities?
So the intellectual property rights systems that are developed in the north prioritize industrialized farming systems.
Yeah.
So you have a situation where less than 10% of the population is involved in agriculture, and many of those are corporations, they're multinational corporations, and they use additional inputs, lots of additional inputs in producing.
Yeah.
So many of their own products would perhaps meet conditions for patentability and meet also conditions for plant breeders' rights under the UPOV system, as an example.
Yeah.
So that system really just is focused on industrialized commercial farming, and that does not sit well with the African types of agricultural production systems, because we have about 80, in some instances, 90%, depending on the crop, depending on the country, production people involved, small-scale farmers involved. And when we're talking about small-scale farmers, there's a wide range of categorizations. You know, you can, in some countries, you could have less than 2 hectares. You know, some countries will say less than 5 hectares. Some will say less than 10 hectares. But really, it is primarily small-scale farmers that are involved in planting, in growing food. So, first of all, to eat for themselves and their family. So for subsistence, first of all, for their own survival first, and then for making some type of, you know, income to for their livelihoods.
Yeah. Yeah.
So an industrialized farming system that caters to multinational corporation would not fit with the type of subsistence, small-scale farming that is predominant across the continent.
No, I agree with you. But, you know, even when we speak about Europe or European countries, the system is not monolithic. I have met so many farmers from Europe who are not happy with UPOV 91, and actually, because they want to keep the diversity also, and it doesn't allow the diversity. So it doesn't mean that European farmers love UPOV 91. The commercial farmers, yes, but the small-scale farmers in Europe are also against UPOV 91. I just wanted to...
Absolutely, and I totally agree with you. Yeah. There is definitely a variety, right? There's a mix. So even in Europe, like you said, there are small-scale farmers. There are lots of people, that farmers, even people that have other full-time jobs that have allotments, they have small gardens, and you know, so some people are not happy, and there are movements actually around exceptions, around limitations, around recognition of varieties that are suited to particular localities in Europe as well. And the same thing for Africa as well. Some Africans are big, large-scale farmers that want to go to promote industrialized agriculture. So we cannot, when we speak of farmers, we are not speaking as a monolithic group. There is heterogeneity within the farming space. So we should acknowledge that as well.
Let's talk about an issue which we both have a passion for. Because I know Dr. Tolde, I know Professor Ekpere, I've met him and his friends. And I do remember when they were developing this African model law on plant variety protection. I do remember. I do remember Dr. Tolde spending a lot of nights, you know, writing that model law protection. So, and I know that them working... I even went, you know, to some of the restaurants, you know, when they were discussing about, you know, their progresses. So let's start from the basics. You know, what is African model law on plant variety protection, and when and why was it developed?
The African model law on, it's a long title, so I'll just keep it as the African model law, is a groundbreaking instrument that really demonstrates and celebrates the power of Africa to translate their international positions into a domestic law that provides and caters to a cross-section of actors within the plant variety protection space. So it provides for the protection of farmers' varieties, provides for the protection of community rights, provides for plant breeders' rights, and it also contains provisions on access and benefit sharing. So what happened was there were conversations at the international level around the protection of plant varieties. So we know that the TRIPS Agreement entered into force on the 1st of January 1995.
What is the TRIPS Agreement?
The TRIPS Agreement is the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights. It is one of the instruments under the World Trade Organization. It's the World Trade Organization instruments are a single undertaking. That
what
means
do you mean?
That when you sign the to the WTO, to the World Trade Organization, you are signed on to all the instruments in the World Trade Organization. So many African countries were pulled into the World Trade Organization because it was a single undertaking. For example, they wanted access to markets for their agricultural products. So if you want that under the Agreement on Agriculture, you cannot pick and choose. You have to sign up to the whole WTO instrument. So that was how many countries, many African countries, signed up to the World Trade Organization and became members of the World Trade Organization, and they had the obligation under the TRIPS Agreement. So Article 27.3b of the TRIPS Agreement provides an obligation for all member states of the WTO to protect plant varieties through either a patent system, an effective sui generis system, or a combination of systems. Patent is clear. For a plant variety to be patentable, it has to be new, it has to have an inventive step, or it should not be non-obvious, or it has to have industrial application, and it should not be excluded subject matter. But effective sui generis was not defined. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to take the literal meaning of sui generis, it means literally of its own kind. Mm-hmm. So it means it's a unique system, it's a special mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. It's a system that can be constructed mm-hmm. in a way that a country deems best suited to its national realities. Yeah. Or the third option is that it should be a combination of systems. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Article 27.3b was a compromise text. Mm-hmm. So there was a discord amongst the negotiators around what the exact provision should be. Mm-hmm. Some countries like the United States were happy to go all the way to have patent systems. Mm-hmm. The European Union said, no, we want to have a specific plant breeders' rights system. Mm-hmm. African countries wanted the incorporation of provisions like access and benefit sharing.
Yeah.
So eventually it was a compromise text, and that was mm-hmm. why we had the options mm-hmm. with a clause to say that this provision will be amended 4 years later. Mm-hmm. It will be reviewed 4 years later. Mm-hmm. Now, 4 years later was supposed to be 1999, mm-hmm. and then there were questions around the definition of review. So mm-hmm. are we reviewing the substantive provisions, yeah. or are we reviewing the implementation mm-hmm. of those provisions? And up to date, this is 2025, that provision has not been reviewed.
Wow, it's a long time.
So we can see, first of all, the controversy mm-hmm. in the introduction of that provision. Mm-hmm. But beyond the TRIPS agreement, we also had other instruments mm-hmm. at the time. We had the Convention on Biological Diversity, mm-hmm. and that was really promoting access and benefit sharing. So that yeah. means that if you're going to take a variety of, let's say, mango, and mm-hmm. you want to improve that variety of mango, mm-hmm. first of all, for you to have access to the foundation mango, to mm-hmm. the baseline, you have to have prior informed consent of the community where you are taking
mango.
Yes,
yeah.
from. You have to have disclosure of origin. So you have to state yeah. where the origin or the source of that mango was. And then you have to have some type of equitable benefit sharing structure. Mm-hmm. That's what the Convention on Biological Diversity introduced yes. at the time.
Yeah.
So what happened at the international level was there were these competing conversations. We had patent systems. We had the plant breeders' rights system. Mm-hmm. UPOV was introduced in 1961.
Yeah.
That's the International Convention for the Protection of New Varieties of Plants. Mm. Before that, we had the International Undertaking on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture under the Food and Agriculture Organization. Mm-hmm. But that international undertaking was not legally binding.
Yes,
so that means
yeah.
it was not
a soft law.
It was a soft law. Yeah. So what Africa said at the time was, actually, their preference was, first of all, ensuring and prioritizing the access and benefit sharing provisions and also prioritizing the farmers' rights provisions in the international undertaking. Mm-hmm. And Africa then took together all of these provisions that they wanted to push forward, but they were unable to have a home for it at the international mm-hmm. level. And they came back to Africa under the Organization for African Unity, now the African Union, to establish the Modul Law. Other Global South actors that did the same, India, for example, went back home
yeah.
and introduced the Protection for Plant Varieties and Farmers' mm-hmm. Rights Act. Mm-hmm. Thailand did the same and introduced protection.
So was it a parallel exercise then?
Yeah, so it was around the same time. So Thailand was 1999.
I didn't know
India
that.
Was about 2001. So it was the same discussion they were having at the international level. What they then did was, you know what, if we cannot have the law from the top down, we can have it from the bottom up. Mm. Let's go back home. So Tewolde, Professor Ekpere, all of them, Maurice Iwu, all of them came together and said, we can actually construct our definition of an effective sui generis system.
Yeah.
And the result was the African Modul Law.
Excellent story. Thank you very much. How does it differ from UPOV 1991 in terms of values, structure, and intent?
First of all, it recognizes the types of diverse systems, seed systems that we have in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It recognizes that farmers are breeders.
Mm-hmm.
It recognizes that communities, farming communities, contribute to breeding. Mm-hmm. It recognizes that there are traditional farming practices that result in innovative types of plant varieties.
Mm-hmm.
It recognizes that Africa is rich in biological diversity. Therefore, if anyone is going to source those biological diversity resources from Africa, they need permission to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it is different from UPOV because of the comprehensive provisions it incorporates. It incorporates the protection of farmers' rights, of access and benefit sharing provisions of community rights and obviously of plant breeders' rights as well. Well, like we have said, UPOF only focuses on plant breeders' rights with a strict and rigid provision stating that no additional provision could be incorporated in a UPOF-styled law. So the model law is more inclusive, comprehensive, and suited to the socio-economic realities in Africa.
That's beautiful. The model law adopts a sui generis approach, as you say. Can you explain what that means and why it matters?
So a sui generis system, like we have said, literally really means of its own kind. So model law is an example of a sui generis system.
Yeah.
UPOV plant breeders' rights system is an example of a sui generis system. Sui generis just means that you have created a unique, a special law, and you have incorporated provisions in that law that you feel are suited to your interest. For the global north, for European actors, the provisions of UPOV are suited to their socioeconomic context and to their industrialized farming context, and they have that as a sui generis system. For Africa, we have said that the African model law is suited to our own socioeconomic realities and our own context, and that makes it a sui generis law. Effective, I would say, could mean fit for purpose. So if you're going to say whether or not a law is effective or whether or not a law is an effective sui generis law, it is, first of all, is it a sui generis law? That means, is it a unique law? Is this a special law? The answer from the African model law perspective is yes. And effective, is it suited for its purpose for which it was constructed? And I would say that the model law is suited for the purpose for which it was constructed. So that would make it an effective sui generis law.
Thank you so much. What legal and political significance does the model law hold in resisting externally driven legal harmonization?
The model law, first of all, was a statement. It was a political statement emphasizing that Africa was ready to design a homegrown law that was suited to its domestic realities. That is a strong statement. And the legacy of the protagonists live on.
I'm going to ask you a very sad question, you know. Today I was, during lunchtime, I was lining up to pick my food. And I had a conversation with one of the participants. And he was saying that when we were developing the African farmers' management system, there were a number of legal frameworks that was put as a resource. And the African model was not among them. Even today, you know, among the majority of the participants, there are very few people who know about that law. So why, despite its progressive orientation, have so few African countries formally adopted the model?
That is a very crucial question. There's a there are a plethora of reasons for that. One is lack of political will of the African countries to adopt and adapt the model law. Second is just really the limited awareness. For some reason, even though Dr. Tewolde, even the Professor Ekwere, traveled across the continent, making it their life's work to promote the model law. It gained limited traction. At the time when they were promoting the law, there was a lot of pushback. International organizations did not want the law to see the light of the day. And there was just a lot of resistance to that law coming out from Africa. So there is just really a big disconnect between the instruments that we have on the continent, like the African Model Law, and what the sub-regional, regional organizations are adopting and also crafting as their plant variety protection laws. And I think primarily limited awareness. And I don't know why there is limited, because the instrument exists and I really don't. I think also it's the African model, the African Union that is supposed to house it, has not embraced it, has not promoted it, has not sponsored it. Many colleagues in the African Union are also unaware of the law.
Yeah, now, but especially.
So.
Yeah. That's very sad. Let's talk about the political economy of PVP and external pressure. What role has FTA, NDPS, you know, donor-driven agendas played in pressuring African countries to abandon the Modi law in favor of UPOV 91 aligned laws? Yeah.
Yes, so many of the African countries that joined UPOV 91 were actually coerced to join them through free trade agreements, through economic partnership agreements. We had Tanzania, we had Morocco, we have a number of countries that have economic partnership agreements and trade agreements that mandate them to join UPOV 91. Nigeria had some partnerships that also required it to revise its seed laws and to, you know, join UPOV 91. So economic pressures have been a strong force in coercing, in pushing African governments to join the UPOV 91. They might not expressly state that those African governments should abandon the Modu law. I think it's just really the language has been about prioritizing the UPOV 91, just marginalizing, not even discussing the Modu law. So that has gradually led to sidelining the Modu law. And many times with technical assistance, with capacity building, the support usually is for countries to join the UPOV 91. And I would also say that the African Union has not been actively been active in promoting the African Modu law as well. So while you have the free trade agreement, while you have the economic partnership agreement, while you have the funding from bodies, you have AGRA, you have Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you have a number of bodies that have been contributing to building agricultural ecosystems on the continent, what they usually mandate or require would be for the African countries to join UPOV 91.
And
the home of the African Module or the African Union has not stepped up to promote the African Module.
Just conveniently forgotten. How do regional organizations like ARIPO and NOAPI fit into the landscape of legal harmonization and influence in Africa?
In Africa, we have an interesting system, an interesting fragmented system, where you have different intellectual property organizations. You have the ARIPO, African Regional Intellectual Property Organization, that caters mainly to Anglophone African countries. And then you have the African Intellectual Property Organization, OAPI, that caters to mainly Francophone African countries. And what has happened is that each of these organizations then introduces their own systems, introduces their own intellectual property laws, and that really has influenced the trajectory of intellectual property lawmaking in their home countries. OAPI adopts a single undertaking, a uniform system as well. So a member of OAPI is a member of all of the instruments under OAPI, and it has direct enforcement. While for ARIPO, you can pick and choose which instruments you want. Now, interestingly, not all African countries are members of ARIPO or OAPI. Many of the big African countries, Nigeria, South Africa, are not members of either organization, so they have their own national laws. There was an attempt to introduce a Pan-African Intellectual Property Organization, PIPO, but that has not fully been executed. But now we have the African Continental Free Trade Area, and that has an intellectual property protocol that will have an influence on all African states. So we have an intellectual property protocol, but there are also annexes that are being drafted and negotiated, and those annexes would help to understand the effect of the intellectual property protocol. So we just have to wait to see what the annexes would look like.
Yeah, let's stay with the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement. How do you view the African Free Continental Trade Area in this context? Is it reinforcing this top-down legal trend?
I don't think it necessarily has to. I think it is trying to revive the Pan-African spirit. So it's trying to build, you know, a Pan-African renaissance. It's trying to say that Africa is actually one. And that Africa has shared interests, And it's part of the African Union's Agenda 2063. We want to push for a strong, united Africa. Mm-hmm. The overarching aims of the AfCFTA, for me, are clear, progressive, but it's really going to be about its execution.
Do they know the Africa Modelo?
I'm not sure. I don't work with the AfCFTA, but I'm sure colleagues in the AfCFTA sector know about the Africa Modelo.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, the Modelo proposes a framework rooted in African legal traditions and farming realities. Can such a model coexist with formal system of trade and innovation? I'm talking about African model law.
Yes, it can. So African model law provides for protection of farmers' varieties. It also provides for the protection of plant breeders' rights. They can coexist. So what it's saying is the African model law is inclusive. So what it's saying is let us grow our agricultural sectors in ways that we are promoting both the small-scale farmers and the large-scale farmers. Let us have insight to agricultural innovation as well as excite to agricultural innovation. The African Modul Law can have complementary types of protection available, and it can also support both the small-scale farmers and the large industrialized farmers.
Oh, okay, thank you. And Jay, what are the risks of a one-size-fits-all legal system for seeds, especially in the continent as ecologically and culturally diverse as Africa?
A one-size-fits-all system means that you're going to be sidelining some actors.
Yeah.
So it means that the system is going to be favorable to some actors to the disadvantage of other actors. That really would be it.
Yeah.
So a one-size-fits-all, depending on what the one size is. If it's a one size for farmers, it means that it's only farmers that will be beneficial, or that it means that the law will only benefit farmers' varieties. If it's a one size that promotes industrialized agriculture, it means that it is only those industrialized actors in the industrialized agricultural space that will benefit. So a one-size-fits-all is certainly not inclusive.
Yeah, for real,
it's, just going to support one group of actors. And we have a varied group of actors on the continent.
Yeah. I said the monoculture mentality doesn't work in this context. Are there real-world examples, you know, within or outside Africa, of countries or communities successfully implementing legal frameworks that honor both farmers' rights and innovation?
Yes, we have examples. India is a well-known example. India provides for the protection of new plant varieties. It also provides for the protection of extant varieties. Extant varieties means varieties that are already existing, and part of extant varieties are farmers' varieties. These farmers' varieties do not need to meet the commercial novelty, distinctness, uniformity, and stability conditions. India would be a good example for us to consider in terms of whether or not implementing the Modul Law could be practical or successful. I'm not saying that India is perfect. India has their questions around the implementation of their plant variety protection law, but it is a step in the direction of showing that it's possible for you to have a system that recognizes both small-scale farmers' varieties and the new plant varieties.
Thank you very much. How does African Model Law align with frameworks like ITPGRFA and the Nagoya Protocol or UNDROP?
So the African Model Law was introduced before the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture was adopted or before it entered into force. However, it anticipated its provisions, and that's why it introduced and includes provisions on farmers' rights that we can say are similar to the provisions on farmers' rights in Article 9 of the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture. Provisions in the Nagoya Protocol on fair and equitable benefit sharing, we could see that also contained in the African Modul Law, and also provisions from the UNDROP that draw from the International Treaty and the Nagoya Protocol are also incorporated in the African Modul Law.
Okay. Perfect. Do you see these instruments as tools African countries can use to push back against Europe of 1991 and reclaim space for alternative legal systems?
Absolutely. I think that they provide the tools. I think they provide, they set out examples of provisions that African countries can adapt into their own laws.
Looking forward, I'm on the final set of my questions. How do you see the future of African model law? Can it be revived, updated, or adapted for today's challenge?
Absolutely. The African model law is a living law. It is a law that provides a framework, that provides standards. It is time to review the law. It is time to update the law. It is time to celebrate the law. And it is time to embrace the African model law.
The people who have already drafted that model law, you know, we have to celebrate them. What strategies, legal, political, environment-based, movement-based, are needed to defend and implement a more just and Afrocentric seed governance framework in Africa?
I think first of all is education and training. So first of all, we need to understand what an inclusive seed system means. We need to understand how to craft inclusive seed systems. Once we have that education and training in place, we could then begin to disseminate knowledge about that. And we could also ensure that they are contextually appropriate. So not all African countries are not homogeneous. We also have to ensure that the laws that are going to be introduced are going to be fit for the countries where they are going to be introduced.
My final question, Ntiti, if you had the attention of all African ministers of agriculture and trade in one room, you are speaking in the African Union, what would you tell them about seed laws?
I will, first of all, introduce them to the African model law.
Okay.
And then I'll tell them the importance of the model law. And then I'll tell them how that also works alongside seed laws. So I'd say that while you can have plant variety protection laws, it's also important for you to have inclusive seed laws, because seed laws affect the registration, the release, the marketing, commercialization of seeds in Africa. So I would say, let's ensure that we have inclusive plant variety protection laws as well as inclusive seed laws. I'll tell them the impacts of that, and I'll paint a picture of the current realities on the continent with regard to our seed production. And I'll ask them how they think we should best address the varied seed system and plant variety protection system that we have. And I'm sure that their answer would be for us to build an inclusive and comprehensive plant variety protection and seed law system.
Thank you, thank you, thank you so much, Ntiti. This is fantastic.
Thank you so much.
I learned quite a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm so happy to meet you.
Thank you,
honestly.
I'm happy to meet you as well.
Really fantastic.
Thank you,
thanks
my pleasure.
A lot,
Thank you, my pleasure.